From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, flight, from migrating birds to space travel to Mars. First, we talk with birder and naturalist Scott Wiedensahl about the incredible stamina of the migrating bird. Some of them fly 5,000 miles without stopping. Wiedensahl's new book is Living on the Wind. Then, how likely and how soon could we be setting up space colonies on Mars? We talk with astronomer Donald Goldsmith about the future of space travel. He was consultant to the PBS series Voyage to the Milky Way and wrote the companion book. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate failed to agree today on an emergency aid package for American farmers. Republicans offered $6.7 billion, while Democrats pressed for nearly $11 billion in aid. Lawmakers say a compromise is still possible this week. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
The combination of severe drought and collapsing crop prices has devastated some segments of the U.S. farm economy. Democrats rejected the GOP emergency aid plan as too small and not addressing the drought problems, while Republicans complained that Democrats were using the emergency to try and rewrite the 1996 Farm Bill. In the end, neither side had the votes for its proposal. Iowa Democrat Tom Harkin said despite the lack of a decision, progress was made.
Bad news is we lost our package, but I think the good news is that there is now at least bipartisan recognition that there is a disaster out there, both the natural disasters plus the fall in the prices that need to be responded to.
Lawmakers say talks on emergency aid for farmers will continue this week. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, the Capitol.
President Clinton called on business executives today to help reduce the nation's welfare rolls by taking part in the Welfare to Work program. At a conference in Chicago, the president noted that the number of Americans on welfare is the smallest it's been since 1967, but he said that more people can be helped to move from public assistance to the workforce. He called on Congress to use $4 billion in unspent welfare funding to help recipients get job training, child care, or help with transportation to work. A Salt Lake City businessman pleaded guilty today to the first criminal charge resulting from the Olympic bribery scandal. From Salt Lake City, NPR's Howard Berkus has details.
The guilty plea resulted from a scheme to win the support of a Korean member of the International Olympic Committee by employing his son and helping the son gain permanent resident status in the United States. David Simmons agreed to plead guilty to a misdemeanor charge of filing a false tax return in exchange for his continued cooperation in an ongoing federal criminal probe. Simmons once ran Keystone Communications, the company that hired John Kim, son of powerful IOC member Eunyoung Kim. Documents filed in federal court say the scheme was arranged by an unnamed official of the Salt Lake Olympic Bid Committee before Salt Lake City was named host of the 2002 Winter Games. Simmons identifies the official as Olympic Bid Chief Tom Welch, who denies any wrongdoing. I'm Howard Berkus, NPR News, Salt Lake City.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 31 points to close at 10,677. Declining issues led advances by nearly 2-1 in moderate trading. This is NPR News. A panel of arbitrators has ordered the federal government to pay $16 million to the heirs of Abraham Zapruder, the man who shot a historic home movie of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. The family had asked for $30 million, and the federal government offered $1 million. The arbitration panel was selected to determine what compensation the family was entitled to after the federal government claimed the film on behalf of the American people. 2 months after Indonesia's general election, the country's president is now declaring the results valid and final, but the issue remains unsettled. Lisa Rose Weaver reports from Jakarta.
President Habibie wielded executive mandate to end weeks of squabbling among politicians and election officials about the results. Some had pointed to alleged vote rigging. Others were unhappy because their parties did not gain seats in parliament. Indeed, the ultimate endgame comes in November when members of parliament elect a new president. But already for weeks, the general election returns have shown opposition leader Megawati Sukarnoputri, who has already declared herself the country's future ruler, in the lead. Behind her is the ruling party of President Habibi. Members of parliament say they fear the people power groundswell behind the reform-minded Sukarnoputri could turn to unrest if her supporters perceive how they voted bears no relationship to what parliament decides in the fall. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Rose Weaver in Jakarta.
Police in eastern India want to question four railroad signal operators who are suspected of negligence in yesterday's train crash that led to at least 257 deaths. Officials say the signal operators fled the scene after the crash and that one is still missing. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane in for Terry Gross. Before too long, you'll begin to notice the skies filling with birds making their way south to warmer climates. Scientists and birdwatchers have always been impressed with birds' ability to fly thousands of miles each spring and fall against headwinds, against the odds, and with few hospitable resting areas along the way. My guest, Scott Widensall, is a birder and nature writer who has just written a book about the complexity and wonders of avian migration. Living on the Wind is about how and why and where birds migrate and the biology of migration that still confounds scientists. Scott Widensall leads guided natural history tours, and he bans hawks and owls in the mountains of eastern Pennsylvania. He writes the Nature Watch column for the Philadelphia Inquirer and also writes for Smithsonian Magazine and other publications. His book, Living on the Wind, includes maps of migration routes. I asked him if birds really follow a specific route when they migrate.
There are very definite routes that some of these species take, and they're not accidental. They're shaped by landforms, they're shaped by water barriers, and particularly shaped by wind patterns. You find that even with species like short-tailed shearwaters, which nest on the islands off Tasmania, travel completely around the Pacific Rim and spend the summer in the Bering Strait feeding. They follow a fairly precise route in this figure eight back to Tasmania, and they arrive back in Tasmania at a rate of about 20,000 per hour within the same 10 or 12 day period every year, right before the breeding season starts again. So these birds are not just global commuters, but they're doing it on a very tight schedule.
Well, what is it that activates this migratory impulse? And I was actually curious to read that a lot of these questions are really unanswered, they're not complete answers.
They're not complete answers. We do know that it's not what people assume. It's not cold weather coming on. It's not hunger that triggers this. Most of the birds start migrating in the fall before the weather gets cold, and they migrate when they're at their fattest, so one assumes that they're not particularly hungry right then. What seems to be the trigger is the changing amount of daylight and sunlight, what's called the photoperiod. In the spring, the days are getting longer, and that triggers changes in the bird's hormones, and that sets off these urges. None of this is a conscious decision. The bird doesn't get up in the morning and say, I'm getting tired of Guatemala. I think it's time to go back to Ontario. Their strings are being jerked essentially by hormonal changes and that they have no control over. And many of these birds, especially in the fall, these are birds that have never been to where they're going. These are young birds that have just hatched. Their parents abandoned them a long time ago. They don't travel in family groups, with the exception of a few groups like ducks and geese and cranes. Almost all other birds travel alone or in flocks of the same age. So you get this young bird that's only out of the nest 6 weeks, and it has this overwhelming compulsion to head in a certain direction at a certain time of the year for a certain length of time. And all of that is genetically encoded.
So you're talking about a, quote, urgency to fly. You even talk about a blind faith. I mean, of course, that's a human being writing about it. But,
sure.
But if they're covering 10,000 miles, there is a certain kind of blind faith.
Exactly. The bird doesn't know where it's going or how it's going to get there or what it's going to find when it arrives. It just knows that it has to do it. You can take a bird, and people noticed this as far back as the Middle Ages in Europe, when they would catch these songbirds like linnets and nightingales and would put them in a cage, and come fall, when the days were getting shorter, the birds would get very agitated, and they'd hop in a certain direction. They'd keep banging against the bars of the cage on the southern part of the cage. And that's known as premigratory restlessness. And they get more and more restless until one day they can't stand it anymore, and they start flying in that direction.
Hmm. Kind of like spring fever, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Sort of human equivalent.
Comes twice a year. They get fall fever as well as spring fever.
Who would you say is the most sort of impressive migrator? Perhaps it's maybe the tiniest or mm-hmm. the longest trip, the most arduous journey that you've seen.
There's two. There's a little tiny bird called a black pole warbler. Hmm. It weighs less than half an ounce. You could mail two of these things anywhere in the country for a 33-cent stamp.
Less than half an ounce?
Less than half an ounce. It's about 4 inches long. And, of course, most of that is feather. Black pole warblers breed across New England and Canada and Alaska in the boreal forest zone, in the spruce forest zones. And let's just, for the sake of argument, take a black pole warbler that hatches in extreme western Alaska. Now, instead of taking the logical route due south, this bird will actually fly east across all of Canada for 2,000 or 3,000 miles until it reaches a staging area in the Canadian Maritimes and along the New England coast. And some of those birds in the fall come as far south as Pennsylvania. And they're waiting there for a big cold front, big strong weather system to come through with strong northwest winds. And again, instead of then turning and flying south over what we would think of as safe land, these birds follow the winds out to sea, out to the Atlantic Ocean, and the wind carries them for hundreds of miles out over the western Atlantic, and they sort of slowly start to curve back. When they get over about Bermuda, the wind starts to fail, and they start picking up the northeasterly trade winds that are coming in. That kind of curves them back in toward land, so they're coming in over the Lesser Antilles, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 feet up. You can see them on weather radars, these little greenish blobs going over. And then they start to drop down toward the northeastern coast of South America. It's about an 80-hour trip. And, of course, they're doing this without rest, without food, without water. They're beating their wings about 4 or 5 million times during the course of this 80 hours. I've heard it described as somebody running 4-minute miles for, you know, 2.5 or 3 days. Imagine the kind of exertion that calls for, and an animal that's not a whole lot bigger than, you know, two of your fingers put together.
But what it's doing, though, is hopping the winds. I mean, I would assume for a lot of birds that's going to be one of the ways that they're going to get accelerated to their destination.
Exactly. And you asked about another migrant. And one that's only just come to light in the last 2 years that depends on winds utterly for its migration is the bar-tailed godwit, which breeds in western Alaska. It's a shorebird. The body's about the size of a pigeon, but it's got this, you know, long, skinny legs and this long ice pick of a bill. And in September, these birds gather on the shores of the Alaskan Peninsula, and they feed on little tiny clams in the tidal flats until they are 55% fat. Hmm. This is the fattest wild birds that have ever been found. And then their entire digestive system shrinks down to almost nothing. It just atrophies. The stomach shrivels. The intestines shrink down. The kidneys go kaput on them. The liver shrinks, sheds all this extra weight. And they wait for these big gales that come out of the Aleutians with like 80, 90-mile-an-hour winds. And when the wind direction shifts to the right compass point as the storm passes, all these godwits take off, and they fly directly out into the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And they get this slingshot effect for about 1,500 miles from the wind. Now, we don't know if, as they're flying along, if they're flying at their normal airspeed, which is about 60 or 70 miles an hour. They're very fast birds. So if you add 60 and 70 miles an hour to the 80 or 90-mile-an-hour winds, or if they scale back their effort to try to conserve energy, scientists are still working on this. But these birds make a 6,800-mile nonstop flight directly across the widest part of the Pacific Ocean. They don't stop at Hawaii. They don't stop in French Polynesia. They don't stop anywhere along the way. They finally come for a landing in New Zealand and Australia, where they promptly regrow their entire digestive system and start feeding again.
Boy, talk about the adaptation, right, and evolution
staggering.
At work.
Absolutely staggering. I mean, to think that a system like that would even work once in a while, much less work year after year for the vast majority of that species.
Well, that's why you say migration is not for the faint-hearted.
That's
right?
True.
you got to be ready for that. One of the scientists that you quote saying, in terms of talking about an impressive biology, mm-hmm. that if we were to take a birds on migration, the sort of equivalent miles per hour in our sort of gallon mentality mm-hmm. would be something like 250,000 miles. Per gallon, right?
Well, actually, yeah, I think the figure actually was like 720,000 miles per gallon if they were burning gasoline instead of fat. Because you're talking about, in some of these small birds, they're crossing the Western Atlantic or the Gulf of Mexico on 2 or 3 grams of fat. Hmm. You could put 2 or 3 grams of fat on the end of your index finger and have room left for more.
And that's why this migration is so important to try to understand.
Absolutely.
Because it gives you a little snapshot into how a system works.
Absolutely.
One of the things that you talk about and you mentioned earlier was that the birds sort of noticed the light change, and that seems to activate this mm-hmm. migratory response. But you also seem to say that there's some sense of the Earth's magnetic field,
sure.
low-frequency sound waves, that all these things are sort of working on a bird's
right.
System.
Right. The changing daylight and darkness, that's what triggers the migration. But, you know, just because the bird's up and flying, it still has to know where it's going. It has to pick a direction. And there are actually two tasks that the bird has to do. One is orientation. It has to know basically where's north, where's south, what are the cardinal points. And then it also has to navigate, which means it has to know where it is in relation to the landscape. We have a pretty good notion of how birds orient themselves. It appears that the two most important cues for them are celestial landmarks. A lot of these birds fly at night, even songbirds that are normally active by day. So they're using the rotation of stars around Polaris. So not looking up and saying, oh, well, there's Cassiopeia, now I have to make a left. They're just sort of aware of the rotation that shows them where north is. And they're also very sensitive, as you said, to the Earth's magnetic field, which is extremely faint. And there's some concern that as we put more and more electromagnetic radiation into the environment, that may have an effect on birds. That hasn't been shown yet experimentally, but there's some concern about that. But they also use, as you said, extremely low-frequency sound. Some species of birds apparently navigate by using smell. Most birds have a poor sense of smell, but many seabirds have a good sense of smell. Homing pigeons in some areas seem to use smell. They use landmarks. As they get older and get to know the area that they're returning to, they'll obviously use visual cues. How they navigate, though, there's not nearly as much information on that. It appears that much of it is just genetically encoded, what's called a time-distance program, where the bird has an instinctive urge to fly in a certain direction for a certain length of time, certain period of days, and then it will change its orientation and fly in a somewhat different direction. It's kind of like if you were ever in Scouts, you're running an orienteering course with a compass. You're given a set of directions. Go 115 degrees for 15 steps, turn 114, and you can work out this complicated route even though you don't know where the end is. And it seems that that's how birds are navigating extremely long distances.
Well, it's interesting to think, and again, this is using a sort of a human word, but how they, know once they've gotten to where they want to go.
Right.
How do they know that they're there?
Well, yeah, that's a real good question, and we don't know. There's been some... It was always assumed that as birds, when a young bird arrived, say, in the tropics, a bird that was hatched in northern Canada arrives in the tropical rainforest or in a pine oak forest in the highlands of Mexico, how would it know the right habitat? And it was always assumed they kind of wandered around until they found the right spot. Well, they've been doing research that shows no. They arrive and bam, they're in exactly where they need to be. And how they're doing that is a mystery to me.
Well, I was surprised to read, and I don't know whether you were surprised to find that most birds migrate at night. Or a lot of birds. I think that the feeling is, and perhaps here in the Delaware Valley, it's fall, you look up, and there are the geese heading south.
Exactly, or the flocks of robins, which are among the relatively few diurnal migrants, daytime migrants. The vast majority of songbirds, many waterfowl, many shorebirds, all migrate at night. And the reason they do it seems to be that the night is a more favorable medium for them. The air is less turbulent. It's cooler. It's moister, because a lot of these birds, their real danger is not exhaustion or lack of food, but that they're going to dehydrate because they're losing so much moisture as they're breathing. There are fewer predators to worry about after dark.
Is it quieter at dark?
It's somewhat quieter, and of course, then they have also the advantage of using celestial navigation. So when you look, you can actually log on the internet now on some of the NEXRAD Doppler radar sites, and click on clear air reflectivity, which I have no idea what that means, but that's the radar setting that ornithologists are using. You can actually see these flocks of birds moving across the landscape, particularly as they're crossing the Gulf of Mexico, where you get these enormous fallouts of birds arriving at a rate of hundreds of thousands per mile of beach per hour, and you get these great blossoms of color on the radar screen of red and orange and blue as these enormous, millions of birds crossing and making landfall. And it's all happening often under the cover of darkness, and people have no clue as to what's going on over their heads.
What percentage of birds don't make it? And is this the sort of, you know, survival of the species
Absolutely.
At work? If you can't make it from, you know, Alaska
process.
To Guatemala, mm-hmm. you ain't going to make it.
It's a winnowing process generation after generation, and in some cases probably about 70% of the birds that are hatched each year don't make it to their first birthday.
70%. And they don't make it in this migratory run.
Well, they don't make it during that period, but of course migration winnows out a great many of them.
I'll talk more with birder and nature writer Scott Wiedenthal about bird migration after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Let's get back to our interview with nature writer and birder Scott Wiedenthal. His new book is called Living on the Wind. I asked him about how development, suburban sprawl, and highways are affecting the habitats of migrating birds.
It's definitely having an impact on migratory behavior. You have to think of migration as a web, as a global web, or a chain in which every link is just important as every other link. And what we're doing with our development and our changes in the environment is breaking those links. And we're not doing it intentionally. We're doing it frequently without giving a thought to what the consequences are. And so you have a bird that has just passed the winter in along the Gulf Coast or down in Central or South America, and it flies back to its nesting site from the previous year and discovers that what used to be a nice tangle of oak and hickory is now oak forest estates, and it's been chopped up into pieces. And even if they can find a place, let's say you're a wood thrush and you're looking for a fairly large tract of woodland in which to nest, you build your nest. Well, now there are houses nearby, there are cats, but there are also natural predators that thrive around disturbed habitats, like raccoons and possums, blue jays, grackles, all of which feed on eggs and chicks. There are also brown-headed cowbirds, which are a native species that will throw out the eggs of the host bird and lay their own eggs in its place. And the parasitism rates on these many wood thrush nests in particular are extremely high. This is a bird that the wood thrush never had to worry about back in the days when eastern North America was a pretty much solid blanket of forest, because the cowbird is found mostly in open habitats. But as we fragmented the breeding grounds, it's made life very, very difficult for some of these birds.
But how fragmented can it be before it really has an impact on migration?
Depends on the bird. We don't know that yet. And there's a lot of really frantic work going on right now by ornithologists and other field biologists trying to learn the answers to that. Some birds can do very well in fragmented habitat. It just depends on the species. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are migratory birds that like robins, for example, are a migratory bird. Well, no one can argue that development has been bad for robins. They're one of the most abundant species in North America. And what the conservation community has been doing in recent years is assessing all the different threats that apply to each bird at each point in its life cycle and trying to gauge which of those species are at higher risk. It's what's known as the watch list. And so you have a species like a robin that has a relatively short distance migration, a wide range, and is rather eclectic in its habitat choices. That's a very low-risk species. You get a bird like a cerulean warbler, which nests in eastern North America. It prefers very large, unbroken tracts of forest. It has a very long migration. It travels down to the foothills of the Andes, so it has all the risks that are attendant with long migration. And it winters in a very narrow altitudinal band in the Andes, only about a 2,000-foot elevation. And it just happens to be the elevation that's perfect for growing coca for cocaine and has the most valuable hardwood forests in South America. So it's getting walloped at every point of its life cycle. That's a very high-risk species. And so conservation efforts and research are focusing on species like that.
You also write about the fact that the overpopulation of deer has had an
Absolutely.
Impact on the forest and the undergrowth, and that is having a kind of a domino effect on bird migration.
It sure is. That's been a long-standing problem and one that's only recently been getting a lot of attention. I live up in Schuylkill County, up in the mountains, and our deer populations up there are probably average about 25 to 35 deer per square mile. But when you get into more suburban areas where there's less deer hunting, the deer populations in some places are 70, 80 deer per square mile. And anything above about 15 deer per square mile has a real impact on the forest. The deer feed very heavily on the underbrush and on the lower branches of the trees. It's kind of like they've eaten the middle out of the sandwich. And so species like indigo buntings and oven birds and wood thrushes that nest in that from the ground up to about 15 or 20 feet high lose their habitat for nesting. And it's had really devastating impacts on birds, not just in Pennsylvania. I mean, deer overpopulation is a problem just about everywhere that white-tailed deer live.
Are you optimistic that, in 100 years we'll have the variety of birds that we have today? Or
well,
are
no,
the threats to...
There's no future in pessimism, so I try to keep myself optimistic. We're certainly going to lose some. We're going to lose some species. We're going to lose some migrations. But the thing that makes me hopeful is that we now recognize what's at stake. And I think people understand, for the most part, even if they're not birders, that there's this thing that goes on that's much bigger than them, that's much bigger than us as a species, that adds immeasurably to the world. I mean, who doesn't thrill in the fall to standing outside and hearing a flock of migrant Canada geese going over high overhead, or seeing the first robin in the springtime? It adds a great deal to our world.
Scott Wiedenthal is a birder and bander. His new book is Living on the Wind. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the future of space exploration and colonization. We'll hear from astronomer Donald Goldsmith, a consultant on the PBS documentary film Voyage to the Milky Way.
The thing.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen, in for Terry Gross. In the 60s, the goal was to beat the Russians to the moon. The space race focused national attention on this single dramatic specific achievement. Now we are contemplating manned exploration of Mars, the exploitation of asteroids for mineral wealth, and continuing the search for extraterrestrial civilizations beyond the Milky Way. But as the goalposts for space exploration have moved past the moon and even beyond the solar system, they have also become more difficult to grasp. That's why we asked astronomer Donald Goldsmith to visit Fresh Air. He's the author of Voyage to the Milky Way, the companion book to the two-part PBS documentary of the same name. His other books include The Hunt for Life on Mars and The Astronomers. Contributing host Barbara Bogave spoke with Goldsmith recently about the evolution of space exploration since we've reached the moon. About some things, like the development of the International Space Station, he's a little skeptical. That's where their conversation began.
Now, some people talk about the space station as the first step towards colonizing space, that it's hugely significant. You disagree?
Well, I do. Of course, in the long run, we are going to have people living on the objects close to the Earth and the solar system, on the moon and Mars, maybe some other places. And when I say the long run, I mean only, say, a century or two, which in the history of human beings, let alone the Earth, isn't very long. But the space station is really just a way of checking out how people can live a long time in space, which will be needed for space voyages. On the other hand, you know, the Russians have already kept people in the Mir spacecraft for more than a year. To keep them in the space station for 2 or 3 years isn't going to be very different. And as for performing tasks in space, I think we know a fair amount about that. So that, seen from a purely going to the planets or going to the moon point of view, the space station is sort of a way station to nowhere. On the other hand, the proponents of the space station would say, well, once you're in Earth orbit, in energy terms, you're halfway to the moon, even though not in distance. And there are important things to learn about human beings' performance in space. So that it really boils down to, in a way, how much you care about taking every cautious, complete step. There are these private enterprise people who want to send people directly to Mars without all this testing and safety business. And they would say this is a complete waste also, but sort of from a different perspective. I feel it's a waste because we shouldn't be spending so much on humans, and they feel it's a waste because we're not going to Mars with a space station.
Who are the entrepreneurs in space exploration?
Well, there's a company called Space Dev, which wants to be the first to land on an asteroid and claim it for their company, and then eventually to strip mine it and use the proceeds to grow rich. On the other hand, to go to Mars, there's a visionary named Robert Zubrin, an engineer who isn't so interested in money, apparently, but is desperately eager to go to Mars, or to send people to Mars anyway, and he just wants to get a stripped-down spacecraft as quickly as possible and get to the red planet.
Why asteroids? What's so important about asteroids?
Well, asteroids come relatively close to the Earth sometimes. On rare occasions, they collide with the Earth, but they're relatively easy to get to, and because their gravity is very small, since the asteroids themselves are small, only a few miles across of the ones they're interested in, these asteroids are easy to land on and easy to take off from and theoretically easy to mine and send the proceeds back to Earth or wherever you want to. Most of them are mostly rock with a little metal, but some of them are almost pure metal, and those are the ones that are dreamed of for pure exploitation.
Do you have ethical concerns about this free market in space?
I'm a little worried in general about the thought that we own the solar system, not to mention the universe. Whether it's the free market or whether it's even the world government that doesn't exist. That is to say, our attitude towards other objects has yet to be well explicated, and it is sort of an ethical issue which relates to how we regard our own planet. I'm very nervous about the thought that in one guise or another, humans would pollute the solar system. For example, when you go to Mars with humans or go back with spacecraft, it's extremely important if we ever want to find out about the origin and disappearance of life on Mars, assuming that happened, that we not find out about the origin of life on Earth, that is to say that we don't take our Earth organisms there and conceal the evidence. And likewise, even on the moon, where there's almost certainly never been any life, the thought of digging up the lunar poles for water that may be mixed in and frozen with the rock there gets me nervous, because before long it'll be gone and all we'll have will be a slag heap.
There are of course, psychological challenges of establishing a space colony, whether on the moon or Mars, and the obvious are survival in the midst of unknown and also physical hardship. One precedent that you cite that I found interesting are the scientific outposts at the South Pole, the men and women who winter over there, who are isolated in the midst of extreme weather conditions. Are there clues from their behavior that tell us about the workings of a colony set apart from Earth?
Well, certainly, the 40 people or so who spend each winter at the South Pole have to live with a knowledge, which has now been in the news a lot, that nobody can get them in or out for about 5 or 6 months in a row. And so the best thing to do is airdrop supplies, which is still, of course, a lot better than a space colony would have. Nonetheless, they've got to live, all 40 of them, in close proximity, in hostile environment, and do their jobs without, you know, knowing that nothing's going to happen until spring comes. And I was at the South Pole and talked to people about this some and learned that, for one thing, there's a reversion towards sort of primitive psychology. That is, rules don't really get much respect just because they're there. Only the ones that make sense get enforced.
Can you give us an example of that?
Well, if things break, they don't clean them up until springtime.
you mean until their parents find out or something?
Essentially, yes. Only when mom comes home are we going to clean up the environment here. I don't know how true that is, but so I've heard. And also that, you know, you don't have as much outlet, so that a fair amount of behavior that's kept under control better in modern society, for example, so-called sexual harassment or just plain sexual interest, tends to take weirder forms. And, you know, if you get an obsession with somebody, it's harder to deal with it because there you are every day, all day long, so to speak, all night long. At any rate, they do survive. I mean, perhaps the most important thing is that they've never lost a person down there, and even though they're dealing with different rules, they're effective rules. And like the old explorers who had their own rules and mostly survived as a result of having a strong leader, the station leader at the South Pole is an important person because he's the one people look to in the final analysis, although, as I say, what really counts is they become more like a bunch of kids with a semi-parent there. But the real parents are absent and won't come home for a while. And I suppose also in a space colony, it would be something like this. Imagine the first dozen people who went to colonize Mars, and they knew the next trip wouldn't arrive for a couple of years. It'd be a good deal like the people at the South Pole, except harder, because they really would be on their own.
I'm talking with astronomer Donald Goldsmith. He's the author of The Ultimate Einstein, The Hunt for Life on Mars, and The Astronomers. His new book, Voyage to the Milky Way, is the companion book to the two-part PBS documentary by that name. We're going to take a break now, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is astronomer Donald Goldsmith. His new book about space exploration is Voyage to the Milky Way. What have we learned from the recent exploration of Mars about the possibility of life on that planet?
Well, we've learned more firmly than ever that Mars used to have running water, as evidenced by the scars on its surface and the floodplains that were examined by the most recent mission to Mars, the one that landed. Also, the mapping of Mars that's been going on has made it abundantly clear that 4 billion years ago, or maybe more recently, but let's say 4 billion years ago, there was water flowing on Mars's surface. And water is thought to be the key to life. You can imagine other liquids, but water is the most natural one in which molecules can float and interact and become more complex structures and eventually produce life. So this means that Mars 4 billion years ago is much like the Earth 4 billion years ago, a planet suitable for life, and now it isn't. That is to say, the water is gone. There's no liquid water on Mars's surface, and no possibility of liquid water. Consequently, what we really learned is it'd be nice to go study Mars rocks and see if they contain evidence of ancient life from, say, 4 billion years ago or 3 billion years ago. The trouble is it's hard to find old rocks. So what astronomers would dearly love to do is get some more missions back to Mars, investigate more territory, and eventually bring rocks back, the most promising looking ones, to Earthly laboratories for examination. And that's what NASA's long-range plan is, where in about 6 years they have such a sample retrieval mission go to Mars.
In determining this possibility of life on other planets in the galaxy, do scientists run into the dilemma or the hitch that we consider Earth a prototype for what is habitable, what can sustain life?
Well, it obviously is going to interfere with our ability to see the full picture. How much of a strong conclusion can we draw from what we know about life on Earth? This, by the way, is the strongest possible reason you can name for finding another form of life, because when you have two forms, you can begin to make important comparisons and draw key conclusions, which you can't do with one. But scientists feel pretty competent and confident in concluding that you need a liquid, something that's called a solvent, for molecules to float in, and that the most likely liquids are things like water and methyl alcohol, because they're made out of the most commonly abundant elements in the solar system, and for that matter, the universe. Of course, we're going to miss some things, and likewise, if we try to make a search for other civilizations by radio, we're going to miss those that don't use radio, for instance. I like to console myself with the thought that, well, yes, we're likely to find first the kinds of life that are easiest for us to detect, namely the ones that are more like ourselves, and later we'll find the others. We can't hope to find everything at once, and if we're restricting ourselves, let's hope it's not too much, and there's still plenty of life out there for us to find. For example, if we go to Mars and look for signs of ancient life, we might miss something, but I would guess that the early forms of life on Mars, which I feel pretty sure existed, would be a lot like the earliest forms on Earth. Not totally identical, of course. And again, if we miss something, well, we'll go back some more and look harder. When you get to talking about life in its most various possibilities, especially when you're looking not directly but by radio signals, well, naturally you're going to eliminate quite a few. And yet still there might be thousands and thousands of possibilities out there.
There is a new rival for most or nearing habitable place in the solar system, Europa, a moon of Jupiter. What's earned it its title?
The key thing is, again, the presence of a liquid. We are convinced now that Europa has a crust of ice, which is kind of unexpected, way out there at Jupiter's distance. But nonetheless, it seems to be clear that almost all of Europa's surface consists of frozen water. And the speculation is high that beneath the frozen water is liquid water, kept warm by internal heat from Europa and protected by this blanket of ice. So that if you could drill through the ice, and under the speculation might be anywhere from a few yards to half a mile thick, you might find a worldwide ocean. And in that ocean, even though it's dark, it could be warm, certainly warm enough to keep the water liquid. Who knows what would be floating? Probably, at best, single-celled creatures, but it'd be wonderful to investigate. At any rate, Europa is a great place. It's 5 times the Earth's distance from the sun, so it's certainly cold, and it's not easy to get to because it's much farther away than Mars. And it's not clear how you would best investigate in an easy way the possibility of life beneath a thick, icy crust. The natural idea is let's go there and drill through the surface, but not easy to do, especially when you don't know how far to drill. And what do you lower through? Obviously, sort of maybe a camera, a collecting sweep. Who knows what, but I think there's a project for the second half of the 21st century.
What do we have to overcome to achieve interstellar flight so we can get to some of these places?
Just time and distance are our little problems with interstellar flight. Since they're talking, just to say it again, about distances millions of times greater than distances within the solar system, this is the great problem in astronomy, that all the distances are enormous, but some are much more enormous than others. We need to find ways to travel much more rapidly than we do now, because our best spacecraft would take nearly 100,000 years to get to the nearest stars, and nobody's willing to invest on this basis. And likewise, if you want to send people, they're not able to go. Maybe you could find a way to freeze-dry them the way they did in Planet of the Apes or something like that. But the better part would be to find a spacecraft that goes, say, 10,000 times more rapidly and approaches the speed of light, or gets to half the speed of light. And that way you could cut the journey down to more or less manageable distances. But it would cost an enormous amount of money and, of course, take a lot of time. And this is why people who search for other civilizations, though there are other reasons to go to the stars, are eager to use radio, which is essentially free. The radio waves travel for almost nothing to produce, and they travel at exactly the speed of light, which is as fast as we think we can go. But interstellar space travel, I think, will come. It's just that it will take, in my opinion, 500 or 1,000 years, or maybe a little longer, which I think I'll say it once again, given how long we have already lived as a civilization, would not be impossible to contemplate. It's just not going to be for us personally.
In the PBS series, your book is a companion to, there are some prototypes for advanced propulsion spacecrafts, and a lot of them look like sci-fi versions of Martian spaceships, or have that classic disc-shaped, light-filled UFO look. Why don't you tell us about some of the design ideas, at least?
Right.
And I guess I'm curious whether designers are consciously or unconsciously drawing on science fiction images of spacecraft and alien spacecraft.
I imagine both, and after all, depending on what you expect a spacecraft to do, it could pretty much look like anything. The ones that don't go all the way down to a planet's surface and just go through interstellar space could have any shape you like, because there's almost a perfect vacuum out there, and it's not a question of aerodynamic suitability. So you can make them like a disc, you can make them like a huge rocket, whatever you like. The real question is, how do you propel them? What's pushing them from one place to another? And it's clear that our chemical propulsion, essentially making little explosions all the time or lighting a fire, isn't going to work. We need more advanced systems, and the ones that people talk about for the nearer future are things like light sails, where you push with a beam of laser beam or microwaves, which are roughly equivalent, on a big, essentially a sail. The trouble is, as you get farther and farther from your source of energy, it gets harder and harder to make this work. But the beautiful idea is it keeps the propulsion system from weighing down the spacecraft. Might be good for really lightweight, automated explorers. There are things like ion drives, where you use magnetic fields to accelerate charged particles. How do you generate these magnetic fields and control them? Again, it's a long story. But essentially, it's a more efficient way to use whatever energy you've got. And the most efficient of all, the ones everyone dreams about, or already seen very much on television and in the movies, are matter, antimatter annihilation systems, where you get 100% efficiency. That is, if you bring matter and antimatter together, you turn all of their mass, and consequently all of their energy of mass, into energy of motion, say of particles such as photons and neutrinos, that can be zoomed out the back and pushed forward. Well, that was a little too easy, because it's not so easy to control their direction. But theoretically, if you had matter and antimatter, you've got the best possible spacecraft. The trouble is, among other things, we have no way to create large amounts of antimatter, and if we did, we have no ways to control it. That is, it would quickly meet with matter and annihilate before you could use it when you want to. Still, in the long run, maybe we'll find a way to do this, and then theoretically, we'd have a drive that could accelerate spacecraft to nearly the speed of light, and away we go.
Is this in the beam me up, Scotty, category of space travel?
Well, it certainly is, because matter and antimatter is already much favored on Star Trek and other such programs and movies. But the fact that it's used in science fiction doesn't mean it's necessarily wrong. I mean, what's really wrong about science fiction movies in general is, again, the time and distance notions that they make it look as though you get there in a hurry, even. And just because you travel at nearly the speed of light, you still wouldn't get there in a hurry. Of course, if you can do warp speed, whatever that is, it may refer to finding tunnels through space where you don't have to go from here to there through all the intervening space, then it goes much more quickly. And some people speculate that such wormholes or tunnels through space actually could exist or be created, but that's very, very far out on the scientific fringe.
Wormholes are these places where space folds back on itself, allowing a shortcut to another
something
time
like that.
And place.
Yes, wormholes
they're theoretical.
Are theoretical places, theoretical ways to make space fold back on itself, if you like. And, you know, I'll believe it when I see it is sort of my gut reaction, but then a lot of science is incomprehensible and unbelievable. The leading proponent of these is a man at Caltech who is well-respected, although he doesn't like getting called up about this, doesn't feel it's totally ruled out, which is a long way from saying it exists or is possible.
What, in terms of new spacecraft, are we likely to see in this lifetime?
Well, if we mean a good long human lifetime, a healthy person at this point, I think we're likely to see something about these light sail or microwave sail technologies and something about ion drives, each of which has the potential to have, you know, much more efficient use of energy and to make spacecraft go at least, I would think, 10 times faster than they do now. But on the other hand, they'll be in their infancy for a while. When I say spacecraft, I don't mean big ones in maybe our lifetimes. Well, maybe the end of young lifetimes will be zipping around the solar system in these things.
I'm talking with astronomer Donald Goldsmith. He's the author of The Ultimate Einstein, The Hunt for Life on Mars, and The Astronomers. His new book, Voyage to the Milky Way, is the companion book to the two-part PBS documentary by that name. We're going to take a break now, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is astronomer Donald Goldsmith. His new book about space exploration is Voyage to the Milky Way. There's seemingly contradictory assumptions held by scientists that civilizations are common throughout the Milky Way galaxy, yet none of them visit Earth. And this is called the Fermi paradox. How do you resolve it?
Well, this is true. The scientists believe that quite likely life is abundant throughout the Milky Way, and in many cases life has evolved what we call a civilization, maybe capable of interstellar travel or certainly capable of interstellar communication with radio. Why then don't we hear from these people or see their visits? And the simple answer, and the most likely answer, is don't forget the distances are enormous and the number of places is huge, which is the very reason why we think life and civilizations could be abundant, that there are so many places that even if most of them don't have anything, it still leaves a lot. But that also means that the average distance between civilizations is measured in the dozens or hundreds of light years, and a light year is 6 trillion miles, the distance light travels in a year, it's an enormous distance. So you might ask, why should these civilizations invest the energy, what we would call money, in interstellar journeys, especially journeys to us? What do we have to offer? And when you think about why we would go, if we could, to the stars, you begin to see both the pro and con of that answer. That is, it's assumed by human beings that once we can make interstellar journeys, we will. At least I think a lot of people assume that. But obviously, the real question would be how much and who's going to pay for it and why should we? And if it takes a couple hundred years for people to come back, who's really going to care to fund them? So it depends on the civilization's attitude. And we may make a mistake in thinking that all advanced civilizations, those are capable of interstellar spaceflight, would have anything like our views. They might possibly have achieved a sort of long-term survival by dropping the aggressiveness that characterizes humans and maybe other young civilizations. It's very useful when you're still fighting for territory, but very bad for long-term survival on a small planet. So all these things have to be factored in, but the brief answer to the Fermi paradox is essentially distances are huge, the number of places to visit is enormous, therefore even if some civilizations do make interstellar space journeys, it's not really surprising they're not on Earth in our era because it's a tiny planet in a small suburb of the solar system, of the Milky Way galaxy. Our solar system is just a little blip on their radar screens.
I'm curious what your view is of UFO conspiracy theories, paranormal conspiracy theories, what it expresses as a cultural trend.
This certainly does say something about the human psyche, doesn't it? Human beings love to believe, have to believe in many cases, for their own survival, that we're not just sort of a bunch of cosmic monkeys adrift in a lifeboat, that rather there's a higher power that looks over us. And whether that's a higher power of conventional theology or a higher power of paranoid conspiracy theory, it's really much the same human emotion diverted into different channels, in my opinion. And it's very important, it seems to me, for our long-term survival, but I'm just one guy, important that we recognize that there is nothing that's going to take care of us but ourselves. Now, you may filter that through a theology, but really it's up to us. Many conventional theologies, of course, say exactly this. At any rate, conspiracy theories speak to the desire that it's more fun to think evil is in charge of the world than incompetence. When you look around you, look at the evidence and ask, which is really more likely?
What's been the most thrilling development or discovery in your lifetime?
Well, I'm tempted to say it's the entire thrust of our exploration of the solar system as far as space exploration is concerned, but in terms of what's really thrilled me the most about astronomy, it's been the deep space cosmological news. For example, the recent news that the universe may be accelerating its expansion and going faster and faster, that every time there's a twinge of exciting news from the cosmological front, I somehow, you know, feel a spiritual resonance that doesn't arise when I'm thinking about merely these little specks that circle the sun and we explore wonderfully, but after all, are just our local environment.
Can you help us understand what is so thrilling about that discovery that the universe is accelerating?
Well, it all depends, of course, on how you see these things. But up until recently, there's a great debate and curiosity among astronomers as to whether the universe would ever cease its expansion and start contracting. This would not happen if it did happen for hundreds of billions of years. But maybe it could be that someday the universe would pull itself together by gravity, as it were, and start contracting and maybe even undergo a new Big Bang, which would be kind of a cosmic recycling and allow us to excuse all our errors over the few hundred million years of expansion and then contraction. So the big debate was there enough matter in the universe ever to stop the expansion and start a contraction? And the new news that apparently the expansion is never going to stop, but in fact will continue on at an ever-increasing rate so that eventually the universe will be sort of completely empty, being having grown to such an enormous volume, resonates in a sort of human recycling mode. It also raises all these wonderful issues of how can the universe expand with nothing to expand into, and where does the universe end, and how could it be finite? All these questions for me just drip with, I don't know if you call it spiritual meaning, but meaning that it's at the edge of our understanding, and if we could only work harder, we might someday figure more out, and we'll never figure it all out. These are what are typically called spiritual questions, and that's to the extent I participate in them is my spirituality.
Donna Goldsmith, I want to thank you very much for talking today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks very much.
Astronomer Donald Goldsmith, consultant to the PBS documentary Voyage to the Milky Way and author of the companion book, he spoke with contributing host Barbara Bogave. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant, research provided by Sam Adams. Bob Purdick is our engineer, and Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Today is the 73rd birthday of singer Tony Bennett. We'll close with a song by him. Happy birthday, Tony.
What a little moonlight can do. Ooh, 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 ooh. What a little moonlight can do to you. You're in love, your heart's a flutter, and all day long you only stutter, 'cause your poor tongue just will not utter the words I love you. Ooh, ooh, ooh. What a little moonlight can do. Wait a while, just a little moonbeam comes peeping through. You get bold, you can't resist her, and all you'll say when you have kissed her is ooh, ooh, ooh. What a little moonlight can do.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Princeton University Press, publishers of The Life of Birds by David Attenborough, a companion to the 10-part TV series airing now on PBS. In bookstores or on the web at pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
After 8 years of a bloody civil war in Sierra Leone, a new treaty offers peace, but many say it's at the price of justice. On the next Fresh Air, we'll hear from Sierra Leone human rights activist Zainab Bengura and the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Mary Robinson. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Join us for the next Fresh Air.